This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
It's not going to be easy to shift from a lifestyle where we've been trained to consume and to use and to take advantage of without really thinking of the inherent costs.
What are you wearing right now? Tube socks from China? A Patagonia fleece? A pair of pants made from hemp? Most people probably don't think that much about the social and environmental impact of our clothing choices. But our guest today on Sea Change Radio, Natalia Allen, believes that you don't have to be wearing a t-shirt with a slogan to make a statement with your clothes. She's been called a conscientious fashionista who not only promotes more responsible consumer behavior, encouraging us all to think about the environmental and human costs of cheap clothing and textiles, she's actually producing clothing and accessories that give consumers a stylish set of alternatives. Today on Sea Change Radio, Natalia Allen talks about making fashion more sustainable and sustainability more fashionable. My guest on Sea Change Radio is Natalia Allen. She is the founder of Design Futurist, which is a product design consultancy specializing in fashion. Natalia, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
What are some of the more recent textile innovations that make you optimistic about where things are headed in your industry?
I mean, there's so many. Right now, my feeling is that the technology far exceeds the opportunities in the design space. So anywhere from the cultivation of new seeds, such as cotton that's grown with the genetic code for a color, as opposed to dyeing the cotton once it's been harvested, to the development of polymers from coconut waste to create fabrics that are inherently flame retardant. That's one area that I'm pretty keen on. Another area, I think, is just looking at traditional fibers such as flax, hemp, and how we can recultivate those fibers to replace more traditional fabrics like cotton, because the price of cotton, as many folks know, is rising. It's about 112% more expensive today than it was last year this time. So companies are increasingly looking at alternatives. And the fantastic thing is that plants such as hemp are a much more sustainable alternative. They grow without a demand for water, the same demand that cotton has. You know, it grows basically in a way that you do not need to fertilize it, use excessive amounts of pesticides, and or irrigate as much.
Tell our listeners about the true cost of cotton. Just because it's cheap doesn't mean it doesn't use a lot of resources, correct?
Sure. I think the costs are externalized. One thing I recently realized when looking at how the developing world is looking at cotton as an opportunity to enter the middle class, when you study the historic price of cotton, it's about as volatile as any commodity price you can find. I mean, the price jumps 100, 200%, dives 50%, dives another, 50%. And so for any emerging economy looking to develop cotton in its conventional sense, it needs to be said that it's a really unstable commodity that has a price that would really shock any economy trying to use it as a means to developing itself.
I read online that just a pair of blue jeans takes around 2.2 pounds of cotton to make, but it's estimated by the World Wildlife Fund that it takes 2,245 gallons to raise that 2.2 pounds of cotton to make that one pair of jeans. That's staggering.
Sure, and then another 700 gallons of water just to dye the thing.
And then the pesticides and fertilizers that go into that process usually as well.
Absolutely. There's a huge environmental footprint. Not to mention the fact that in order to develop those products at such a low price, the industry is really looking to a very inequitable form of labor. I mean, it's asking people to work extreme hours in extreme conditions for very little money. And so our, you know, we're benefiting off the backs of largely women in the developing world who are in very difficult positions because from one point of view, they need the money, right? But from another point of view, is this really fair the way we're asking them to live and to work just so that they could potentially feed their family or just so that they could potentially send their children to school?
And just on the production side, there's also an enormous landfill cost as well with textile waste.
Yeah, ultimately, the statistic that's going today, if you will, cites that the average consumer throws away around 70 pounds of textiles a year. And this number is rising whilst we're experiencing one of the largest global recessions, you know, the world has known. So that is an indicator of how we relate to our products and how fast we go through our products. So the average product is typically lasting around 6 months, and that time horizon is shrinking. So as the world has an increasingly greater need for things such as cotton and, you know, the land on which that cotton is harvested, we're actually using it more inefficiently.
Yes, I saw that in the last 10 years, textile waste has soared 53%, and this is during a pretty major recession. So it might go hand in hand with this quote-unquote cheap fashion and the cheap clothing that people figure, well, it's only $2. There's no point in trying to reuse it or use it as rags or to give it away. These things just tend to get thrown away because of their low initial cost to consumers.
Yeah, I mean, there's a psychological side to it, absolutely, right? A cultural side. If you spend $2 on something and that $2 is not a lot to you, then frankly, you're probably not going to take care of it, appreciate it, want to save it, want to pass it down. The other side is that if something costs $2, principally, it probably is worth what it costs in the sense that it's not very well made, right? So it's not designed to last. And we in the design world describe it as designed for obsolescence. So it's being created with the intent that you will throw it away in a few days' time, in a month time, after one wash. So there's both the sort of economic and physical value of the product, which is inherent in its cost. But then there's the also, you know, the cultural, psychological side, which is if this thing is cheap, I'm probably going to treat it like it's cheap.
Let's go back to some of these newer fibers like hemp, which traditionally you'll see hemp sold in a hemp section of a store, or it's in a pawn head shop, or there's usually it hasn't become mainstream fiber yet for whatever reason. You work with a lot of alternative, quote unquote, alternative fibers. Tell us how what it will take to become more mainstream and for that scale to kick in so that consumers can get cost competitive clothing using alternative fibers that are less of an environmental drain.
Sure. Well, one interesting thing to note is that it's illegal to grow hemp in the United States, whereas Canada has a mature market, China has a mature market. It's illegal to grow in the United States. So there's already a barrier to entry in terms of American companies being able to harvest and leverage a more competitive, more efficient fiber.
And for our listeners, the hemp that's illegal, that's legal in Canada, is not sensimilia or something, medical marijuana being grown. This is completely unsmokable industrial product.
These are industrial plants being used to create beautiful fibers, beautiful fabrics, hemp silk blends, hemp linen blends, hemp organic cotton blends that create textiles that, you know, your most fashionable person would absolutely desire. So there are countries which don't have the restrictions that we have, able to more environmentally sound, in a more environmentally sound way, grow fabrics such as the hemp plant, you know, in order to be more competitive and develop a more sustainable market and make it a more traditional fabric. So you're absolutely right to say that there is a bit of a, I guess, a controversy around hemp. But when you look at the science of the benefits behind choosing a plant like hemp over a plant like cotton, it's, you know, they're just, it's, they're astonishing. I mean, the facts are astonishing. You really need far less water, far less pesticides, far less fertilizer. In other words, you need less of the amount of invasive chemicals, which are derived from fossil fuels, to grow plants like hemp and flax for textiles than you do cotton. But cotton happens to be a very large industry in America, and one that I certainly am not going to be able to personally challenge. You know, there are real entrenched interests in growing cotton, but as we know, there are also real entrenched costs. There's a smart young woman on a light blue screen who comes into my house every night. She takes all the red, yellow, orange, and green, and she turns them into black and white. But you tease, you flirt, and you shine all the buttons on your green shirt. You can please yourself, but somebody's gonna get it. Better cut off all identifying labels before they put you on the torture table.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Natalia Allen. She's the founder of Design Futurist, which is a product design consultancy specializing in fashion. From a consumer standpoint, let's talk about what kind of choices people can make in terms of the labels that they lean towards and maybe some of the retailers.
I begin by saying that, myself included, we all have this culture that we belong to, where we're used to buying new things and we're used to not having to think about how we care for them because there's just plenty. And that's fine. And I think that's something we have to realize and acknowledge, that it's not going to be easy to shift from a lifestyle where we've been trained to consume and to use and to take advantage of without really thinking of the inherent cost. So step one is just acknowledging that we have a lifestyle that is inherently unsustainable, but that's okay. And it's not for one to point the finger at the other, but just to begin realizing that things are the way they are because we were changed over a long period of time. Our habits as consumers have been changed. We've been encouraged to buy more than we need. We've been encouraged to buy things that are disposable. We've been told that that's okay. In fact, we've been told that that's a better way to live. And in some ways, we believe it, and thus we behave that way. And it's entirely rational. And that's really important, I think, to recognize.
So when I go into a Target and I buy a dozen tube socks for $6, that just seems like way too cheap, and it is. But how do we continue buying those tube socks without feeling guilty, or what can we do to kind of counteract that feeling that the fix is in?
Sure. I bring it back to the relationship we have with food. My goal is not to encourage customers or consumers to feel guilty about their purchases. And I don't want them to also live in a sort of survival mentality. I want folks to live optimally. So when thinking about what to purchase, just be mindful. And frankly, we all have a lot of sense. We all have a lot of insight and understanding. when we stop and sort of try to be mindful. So if it's tugging on you to put down those 99-cent cotton socks because you know that they were raised by a farmer who is spraying pesticides without protection and is probably, you know, suffering from his work, and it was probably put together by some young child who was pulled out of school and then shipped halfway around the world on, you know, a sort of false value of oil, and then put it in a store where workers don't have health insurance so that it could be that price. Well, then my instinct is to say, listen to that tug that you have, listen to that impulse, right? And so when we as consumers begin to be mindful and not put necessarily ourselves in a box and say, I can, I can't, but just really be thoughtful about our practices and shopping and why we buy things and if we need them, and challenging ourselves to really think about things, we'll start to see not only new changes in buying behavior, but I think ultimately much more a much more important behavioral shift as a culture towards respecting and appreciating the products that really sustain our life.
It sounds like shifting consumer consciousness and awareness about what goes into their $3 tube socks is an important first step.
Absolutely. What we buy matters. As important as it is for folks to go out and buy the right products, we also have to be sensitive to the fact that companies have a lot of money to tell us what products to buy. So it's not terribly easy to just trust what claims are being made by companies. And thus, I think it's very important for, again, the consumer to be mindful and resourceful and again, really think through as much as possible, however it's possible, in the ways that are possible, you know, what you're buying, and make independent, informed decisions.
And Natalia Allen, you work all along the supply chain. What are some of the more encouraging breakthroughs that you've been witnessing? And you talk about consciousness from a consumer standpoint. What about from a production standpoint?
I think that's a great question, Alex, because so often people look at sustainable fashion as a textile issue. And while the fabric and the fibers from which clothes are made are extremely important, they're not the be-all, end-all. You know, it's an agricultural issue. It's a labor issue. It's a human rights issue, for one. So when I look out on the horizon and I look out on my work, I'm most encouraged by entrepreneurs and especially designers. And I am by no means impartial. But what's interesting about designers and entrepreneurs is that they wear multiple hats. So they're forced to think systemically. They're forced to think through the life cycle of their products, how to be competitive, how to be profitable, how to be efficient, and to be sustainable. So the individuals that are leading the businesses today that are starting, and the businesses that are in their early stages, I think are the most exciting. When you look at a company like Method, when you look at companies that are young and are lean and are excited about how to leverage sustainability and be innovative and really speak to the customer, I think these are the most exciting areas and the most fruitful areas for how to address some of the big problems that we discussed earlier. And for me personally, I'm most excited around how technology can not just be glorified, but how it can be used to solve these big issues in the supply chain. And I'm personally developing new ways to make clothes using technology so that we start to decouple the need for a sort of slave labor and a supply chain that externalizes costs unnecessarily and unethically. When people ask me what are the most exciting things happening, I'm not going to tell you that it's happening inside some big corporation and it's a corporate social responsibility program. You know, the most exciting things that are happening in terms of evolving sustainability or moving it into the mainstream, to me, are not being had inside these CSR machines. They're being had by small entrepreneurs who are on the ground, who are forced to look at the life cycle of their business, the longevity of their business, who don't have an entrenched way of doing things, who can really innovate from the ground up and cut through a lot of the old practices. I mean, the analogy would be, why build telephone lines when you can build one cellular tower? And I just think we're in a completely new generation, a completely new era, a new way of thinking, one where we realize that, you know, there are a billion people moving into the consumer class, and that psychology is, it's done. It's fully baked. So the companies that are out there with interesting CSR projects, I fully respect them and support them, and think anyone that's willing to do something good deserves our gratification, gratitude, right? But at the end of the day, that's not enough. That's not going to get us there. That's not going to help us have the natural resources that are required for the entire global population. That is not going to make equitable the workforce, you know, and the opportunities that people have around the world globally. It's just not enough. So as long as CSR, in my opinion, is a small segment of your company, in other words, it's 1 to 7 people when you have 100,000 employees, I mean, realistically, how much can you get done, and how important is that to the core workings of your business? Every need got an ego to feed. Every need got an ego to feed. She loves the modern, up in the latest fashion. She's in the scramble, and she moves with passion. She's getting high, trying to fly the sky.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Natalia Allen. She's the founder of Design Futurist, which is a product design consultancy specializing in fashion. You see a lot of things that a consumer won't see in terms of the supply chain. What makes your greenwashing radar perk up, and how can a consumer then make a more educated buying decision based on what's a real CSR effort that a company is making and what's just greenwashing?
This is a very difficult thing to summarize, I think, in a few words, but some trends that I've noticed are a shift towards organic cotton, which I'm a huge fan of, because if we are going to use cotton, I prefer us to use organic cotton, although I know that organic cotton is not going to be the solution to the world's need for sustainable textiles. But one thing I've noticed in the fashion world is that there's this use of organic cotton, and the products are being sold at this premium price. But then when I look on the tag to see where that product was made, it says a place like Pakistan. Now, the last report I read said that Pakistan has the cheapest labor in the world, and the payment is actually very volatile, but these women are making next to nothing. Let's just leave it at that. And so I don't understand how a brand could market its products as sustainable and wholesome and designed for you, the customer, knowing that perhaps it's using organic cotton, but it's then dyeing that cotton in toxic dyes, which pose harm to the environment and to our health, and then having that product made in conditions where workers are treated extremely poorly and frankly are underpaid. So if these women are making less than a dollar a day and I'm buying a $30 t-shirt thinking that I'm choosing the right item because I'm buying organic, what I may not be realizing are all the other layers behind what goes into making a product and why that product is not necessarily sustainable.
And I imagine there's been quite a bit more innovation in the high fashion segment of the industry than some might expect.
I think one of the beautiful things about luxury is that historically it's set out with the purpose of designing products that last, right? Products that are designed to withstand some sort of vogue of the time. And there are things that are built with a certain special touch that you want to then share that product with the next generation, if you will. So it's not terribly innovative in the technological sense that you may be looking for, but I think the fact that some of the world's largest fashion companies are companies that have remained true to the vision that fashion is not just about temporary trends that become obsolete, but is really an opportunity to bring beauty into the world of your customer in a manner that it's going to last and be enjoyable and add to the life of your customer and therefore also stay around for generations and not in the landfill, but in your customer's life. I think that's one concept that fashion that's less expensive can really look at and draw upon, and thus we'd all benefit from more behavior along those lines.
Is it a problem with the supply chain or the way our global textile industry has spread out into so many different countries and become so specialized that we can't get something like a one company under one umbrella, like a Nike or even a smaller label, getting a refund kind of and recycling program like you have with a milk bottle, where let's say you wear your sneakers out till they're getting pretty thin, you give them back and those materials get reused and pumped back into their supply chain? Or is that a pie in the sky vision?
You're totally spot on in terms of envisioning that future for fashion and accessories like footwear. And it does exist, believe it or not. There are a small group of companies that are introducing recycling programs. I believe Patagonia has probably one of the most robust programs today for the clothing industry in terms of recycling. The challenge that is really, I think, bigger than changing, I would say the biggest challenge in recycling clothing and or textiles is the lack of technology that exists in terms of how to take a premium product and deliver another premium product. So as it exists today, the technology for recycling natural fibers such as cotton or silk, it is one where the fiber is shredded so terribly that you can't reproduce the same quality long staple yarn to make another product of equal value.
The founder of Design Futurist, Natalia Allen, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Sure, thanks, Alex. Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by David Bowie, Elvis Costello, and Bob Marley. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.